Actually, in the end, I fired everybody except one person. I used to say, I am the shop steward of the Union of Radio Listeners, and they're not happy. I cried.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Giles Squire.
I was born in the 1950s. When I was six, I was sent to a boarding school. The first day at boarding school, my elder brother Guy, who's sadly no longer alive, he, and I'm 6 years old, he took my hand. I remember this so vividly. This is one of the most clearest memories. And he was squeezing it so tight. And this right hand of mine I was holding. I was watching my mum drive away. And of course I was swelling up inside. And standing next, I was almost the same size as the trunk that I had and the top box and all the other things. And I remember my brother taking my hand and saying, "If you cry, I will bash you harder than I've ever bashed you before." And he could bash me because he was 2 years older than me. So I stopped crying and we walked into the school and I saw all the new boys standing there crying and all the older boys laughing at them. And I walked in and I wasn't crying. And my brother did me a favour because I won huge respect from a lot of people because I'd looked as though it didn't matter. It was a strange and horrible memory in some ways because it wasn't really how I felt. So you learn to pretend and keep your feelings to yourself. And that's the start of who I was. Always kept a lot of stuff to myself. It was hard to begin with, but I grew to really love some of the teachers in the school. Very fond of particularly a man called Derek Corbett, who was the assistant headmaster. Derek Corbett had an unusual thing on a Sunday night where you could go and listen to a concert, and they'd play a full concert, classical concert, on a record player, vinyl and everything, and it was really for the senior boys. But I asked if I could go. And I think Derek Corbett was so touched with the fact that I wanted to go into this and listen that he let me in, and of course I probably sat there with my book upside down the wrong way around or whatever, because I couldn't read. But I loved the music, and I sat very, very quietly and I would listen to amazing, amazing pieces of music. Sibelius was first, and actually the thing that triggered it off was the Corellia Suite, which I think was the theme to this week. That kicked off my interest in Sibelius. And I remember for about a year I sat at the bottom of the bottom of the bottom class in the school and didn't move. I was, no matter, the new boys came in or whatever, I was still the lowest of the low at the school. And I remember my mum inspired me in some way with something that if you want to do what you want to do, you're going to have to do something. So the next term I was top of the form. And then I was top subsequently of the next and the next, and I just started rocketing up the school. I think after the second year, my mum was so thrilled that she wanted to buy me a really lovely Christmas present. And she bought me something called Trionic. It's a box full of, not valves, but little transistors, but they're all numbered, and you get a printed circuit, and you get little holes in, and you can put all the things, put all the wire it all up, because it's obviously for 8 or 9 year olds or whatever, you can wire the whole thing up and it becomes a radio and you have a little extra little dial and everything. And I thought this was fantastic. So it seemed different, and I could hear foreign languages and I could hear different, and then your imagination runs wild. Over time, the thing that caught me early on, strangely enough, yes, I obviously when I was at home and stuff, I heard Radio Luxembourg, but the thing that caught me was the American Forces Network.
At the sound of the last tone, it will be 12 o'clock in Central Europe. Stay tuned for news next on AFN.
And I could hear the Johnny Carson show. I don't know who Johnny Carson was, but that was amazing. I used to hear baseball and stuff, and I used to listen to all stuff, on American Forces Network at night. I would listen to Hilversum, and I would listen to Helsinki, and I would listen to all sorts of, and I had no idea sometimes exactly what I was listening to. And I could hear German, I could hear French, and Radio Luxembourg's signal always drifted in and drifted out. It was really peculiar. No one else's signal quite drifted in and drifted out like Luxembourg. I thought, was I supposed to be like that? You know, or is there something wrong with my radio? But no other signal seemed to do that. And like everyone else, one day I discovered a pirate radio station. Come on, sail away with Veronica today. And actually, the first pirate radio station I stumbled across was Veronica. But I didn't know it was a pirate radio station. The station that I grew to love was Radio London. That was the station for me. But strangely, because I've always been a bit strange like that, I actually was really intrigued by Radio 390.
Radio 390, your British family station, brings you Masters of the Organ.
And I didn't understand it, because they'd have, this is Radio 390, Eve, the woman's magazine of the air. And I went, well, what does that exactly mean, you know? I loved the ads were all musical, you know, Use Vitalis and, you know, all these kind of Bulova Watch Time and everything. You know, there were all these wonderful singy song things that you didn't hear on the BBC. And that's the sort of inspired me to think actually radio is where I wanted to be. And I thought, well, how can I be in radio? At the moment I'm learning sort of classical subjects and I'm doing this and, you know, I'm expected to go on and then presumably university and all the rest of it. And how's radio ever going to come in? And I was determined to try and teach myself. And I thought, well, how the hell am I going to do that at school? What I had done is bought myself at home an SP25, a Garrard SP25 and a Garrard SP75, and put them together with a very dodgy amplifier that electrocuted me about 15 times, I think. But having done that, I thought, but the whole of my time I'm at school, what can I do? And I found out there's a language lab in the school and there's a little recording place. And I thought, I have to get into this room. And I went to see my house tutor and said, look, this is what I want to do. This is the reason why I want to do it. And he listened to me and said, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to let you use the room this Saturday for 2 hours or whatever it is. You'll have the key, you'll sign it in, and here are the rules. So I did everything he said, and I produced things. And then one day he said to me, by the way, you're using this room. There's no chance you could actually record the school's program for me. And I said, well, I'd be delighted to. And edited it all up and put it all on a, you know, leader tape and everything, and did the whole thing. He was really impressed. And so I started getting more and more requests. And I said, well, I'm going to need to be in here longer, you know, because I can't do all these things unless you do. So I got access to it pretty much when I wanted to. And I made tapes. And I made tapes for funny little organizations that you could find in the New Musical Express, Melody Maker, and so on, that said, you know, looking for DJs for this or that. And they were basically making pirate radio station tapes and sending them out to listeners. It just seemed very strange. But I got lovely letters from, there were obviously older people who just thought it was refreshing, it sounded funny and interesting, and they loved the songs I'd chosen, and blah, blah, blah. So I thought, oh, that's great. And then one day I saw this advert, and the advert said, new radio industrial radio station opening, broadcasting to factories across the UK. And I thought, well, I've got to send a tape. And I sent a tape in, not really, you know, because I'd sent tapes to all sorts of people and always got wonderful rejection letters. I got a wonderful rejection letter from Alan Keane from Radio Luxembourg telling me that perhaps I wasn't quite what they were looking for. Given I was only 14, that's probably probably fair comment. So at this point, I'm just gone 16 years old. And surprise, surprise, I get a letter back saying, could I attend an audition in St John's Wood, a company called Sound Development, and somebody called Neil Spence, who I'd never heard of before, had written and said, could I attend this audition? And then it suddenly occurred to me, I'm at school. How can I attend an audition? I'm at school. So the... Precocious me went, there's only one thing I can do. I have to go and see the master. You know, and every other voice, please don't do that. Don't even attempt to go and see the master. It was like, you don't go to see the Wizard of Oz, right? It's just not done. I thought, well, you're going to have to do it. I did. I had the appointment. I went to see him. And I do remember, it's exactly as you and I, it's probably all in your imagination, but you can imagine there's always a desk right the other end of the room, and you've got to get from the door right across this huge, cavernous room with the most fearsome looking man that you can imagine sitting at his desk the other side, who actually turned out to be a really nice person who listened to everything I said. Do your parents know about it? And I said, well, given my dad left Westminster School when he was 16 and went to the movies, I don't think he's going to object. He says, well, I'm going to give you an all-day pass, the golden pass, the, you know, the which I was duly given, and I went up to this audition and met Neil Spence, a very articulate man, but very, very, very frightening. I'm 16, but it dawned on me, I recognised his voice. There's something about his voice. And I thought, you know, I've heard this voice before. And it took me a while to connect Dave Dennis with Neil Spence. But it wasn't until I actually started, and he said, that's a lovely one there, that I realised it was Dave Dennis. You know, what minute I went, my God, I've been listening to him for years.
There they are, standing at number 40, possibly for the last time. This very great record of theirs from The Searchers. What have they done to the rain? Looks as though it's going to slip right out of the charts altogether. Here's a man who's never very far out of them, Frank Sinatra.
And we must have had us to school holiday, because I didn't hear anything, and I came back and found I got the job. I went, okay, well, I'm 16, I'm leaving school. I sat my O-levels and left, and I joined UBN, and we started in August of 1970. I brought with me a wonderful little letter which really points out. It says UBN will have three studios which will be completed by the end of July. You will arrive at exactly 11 a.m. on Monday, the 3rd of August, at United Biscuits Osterley Factory and report to the gatehouse, all underlined, for instructions and how to get to the studios. This all sounds very military and martial, he says, but it's essential that you don't get lost in the acres of biscuits and cakes. I would also like to point out that it is unforgivable for you to be late. That sums up Neil Spence. And he says in no answer, not only would this be regarded as unprofessional, but unacceptable. This is Neil Spence. I think as I walked in, Graham Dean drove in his Lotus Elan. I thought, I'm definitely out of my depth here, wandering in off the street, having got a bus. And the studios were right next to the Gillette building. I think Tesco and Sky are where it all is now. But I'd lied about my age. They didn't know I was 16. I thought I was older than I was. Although quite how I got away with it, I have no idea when I think about it today. Pete Reeves did breakfast. Graham Dean did mid-morning. Tony Emerson did afternoon. Dave Anthony did sort of early evening. And I did 8 to midnight. And then there was an overnight presenter. Now whenever I think of Frida Payne, Band of Gold, I think of UBN. That's the song, I think, that because all the girls love that song and they're always requesting it. It's just always, it's a UBN song. It's just one of those songs. When you hear it, they loved it. I was on a two-month contract, which is not exactly, you know, for security. Neil did an unforgivable thing. He was very frightening right at the beginning. He terrified me. I had a very sheltered upbringing and had really heard very little swearing. And I was on air, must have been about 10 o'clock, and I did something. And he rang me up and he used so many different expletives at me and told me if I ever do it again, I was sacked, and put the phone down. And he was really angry. And I had to face another 2 hours, and my hands were I couldn't cue a record up. I didn't know what the hell to do. I was so freaked by it. It was the worst experience, and I vowed I would never, unless it was to impart information that would be helpful or to correct something that was factually wrong, would I ring or interrupt someone on air if I was ever in that position. Not that I ever thought I would be. And Neil was... he was very good, but if I was honest, you'd have to say he would bully you into stuff rather than necessarily encourage. Magic words, tight, bright and real. Tight, bright and real. which later on I thought is absolutely almost an impossibility to do, because you, if you want to be real, then you have to be real. You can't, it isn't real to be smiling all the time. It's real to give something of yourself and to have the angst with other people. That's not, you know, so tight, bright and real. I had to make the brightness, if I was going to be, had to be that there was always something more that was giving you something extra. It was, even if you were talking about something that was very sad, in itself it would be very entertaining and it would make you feel better. The emotional connection made you feel something.
Baking, yeah, yeah. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Biscuits and wafers and tea time cakes. Baked to the tune of da-da-da-da-da.
Those are the days we couldn't play two females in a row. I mean, it's really weird radio. I mean, I learned all sorts of things. You couldn't do this and you couldn't do that. And you couldn't play two slow records in a row. And you couldn't play two women in a row. And you... Also, but Neil was right. You jingled into music. And I used to think, why do people jingle into talk? No, okay, fine, on a talk radio station, but why would you play a jingle that's saying, yeah, bang, we're into something, and then you stop and you talk before you play the record? It's like a punctuation mark in the middle of a sentence. All of those little things just percolated through, and I spent four amazing years at UBN. I joined UBN as Peter Tanner, and there was Pete Reeves there, and there was Peter Sinclair, who was Roger Sinclair's brother, I think. Also, there was an engineer called Peter. So there were always way too many Peters. And Neil Spence, in his own way, says, well, you can't all be called Peter. Since I'm the youngest and I'm, you know, I don't expect Pete Reeves to change his name. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to call myself Giles. So I could be Giles Tanner. That's fine. Because you've got to understand that I was christened Peter Giles Eyre Tanner, but no one ever called me Peter. People only ever called me Giles because my mother thought Peter Giles, when you put the initials, sounded better than Giles Peter. So I was always called Giles. And the only reason I was, of course, I was Peter Tanner was because I thought, when it all goes horribly wrong and doesn't work out, I can just go back to being Giles and we can forget that person. Anyway, Neil used to always come in and go, right, you are Squire, Squire this, Squire that, all the time. Well, how's it going, Squire?
Hi, thank you, Squire, very much.
And I thought, for a gag, I'd call myself, just for one day, while we were training, and I hadn't gone on air yet, I'd call myself Giles Squire. And I made all the jingles up and did all the bits and pieces and went on air, because we were doing dry runs, as Giles Squire. But I picked the day the Sunday Times came in to do a little article on this industrial radio station. And they wrote, and a young aspiring DJ called Giles Squire. And I went, it's never going to get any better than that. That's it. I'm locked into it. And that's it. That's how Giles Squire was born. It was born out of a moment of stupidity, really.
In the UBN production of Treasure Island, the part of Dr. Livesey was played by Roger Day, Jim Hawkins by Graham Dean, Long John Silver by Adrian Love, Squire Trelawney by Giles Squire. The captain was Dave Anthony, Black Dog,
in
Richard James.
In 1973, when the first commercial stations, LBC and Capital, started, I didn't bother to put myself forward to LBC. Adrian Love didn't, of course. I mean, he's a talented and clever man. You know, he had a job at LBC almost immediately. But there was a real feeling at UBN that our time had come and we needed to start thinking about commercial radio. And we certainly didn't want to miss the boat. So I would imagine that every single one of us put an audition tape into Capital. Almost all of us got exactly the same letter back, with the spelling mistake. There's a lot of competition as opposed to competition. We must have all done it. I certainly attended the audition and I clearly wasn't what they were looking for. And I remember going up to, you see, I probably have it here amongst my little bits and pieces. There's certainly the Greater Manchester Radio is there. And there's the, yes, here we are, BRMB. And John Russell. And he asked to see me, and I went up to Birmingham. And he said to me, well, I don't want presenters who know anything about music. Don't you? No, I want presenters who know about Birmingham. I went, well, I guess you can learn either. You could arrive in Birmingham and quickly learn Birmingham, and you can take an interest in music. I bet I could learn Birmingham faster than most people can learn how much I know about music. And thank you very much. That's very interesting. Next. Lovely, lovely. He doesn't sign it. No one signs it. Rejection letter. Unsigned. Perfect. Says all you want to say.
BRMB 261.
So I went next, Colin Walters at what started off as Greater Manchester Radio and became Piccadilly. And well, it had gone quite well. It was a man who just says it as it is, Colin, he just, that's it. You just, that's the way it is, and you take it or leave it, or you battle against it. And he turned around to me and said, yeah, you're all right, but you're too young. I was 20 at this stage, and I'd gone back to my real age. So I thought, here we go again. I'm going to have to lie about my age. So I sent off to Metropolitan Broadcasting. You know, okay, so we've got Birmingham, Manchester. How far north am I going to be?
These tests are to prepare for the start of independent local radio in the Tyne and Wear areas by the Metropolitan Broadcasting Company.
Off to Newcastle, and by this time, an Australian called Don Dwyer had joined us at UBN. Really nice guy, really professional, very, very accomplished broadcaster, but all round nice guy, and very, not big-headed with it at all, very just, very open and very helpful. And Adrian used to call me Strangles, because I had a very upper middle class, but when on air, slightly strangulated voice, which sounded a little bit odd. And it's because a lot of broadcasters suffer from the same thing, is that they don't speak from the diaphragm, they end up talking on air like this, that's a great track, and it's all coming from the top of there and not coming from the whole body. And so between them, they sort of help relax that style and just say, you know, chill, don't be so sort of sound as if you're kind of up there. This is how it happened. We went to this audition at Bloomer's nightclub because there were no studios or anything. I did my audition, and Don did his audition, and they offered Don the job there and then. So I went, okay, well, that's not going to happen again. And by this point, I'd put 2 years on my age. I said I was 22. I thought, well, I'm not going to go up too ridiculous. I'll put myself to 22 now. The next thing that happened that I didn't know about is Don spent the next 20 minutes saying, actually, you should hire Giles. He's very good at what he does, blah, 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 blah. You should hire him. So suddenly we had a job. And I was moving to Newcastle. I was moving from UBN into what I thought, well, now this is going to be real radio. This is absolutely going to be, this is going to be the business. What I didn't realise was I was moving into a television station with no visuals. Metropolitan Broadcasting, MBC, or Metro Radio, depending on who you were and what you were, they were all television people, pretty much all television people, who were at the top of it and had absolutely no idea how to run a radio station. And that sounds horrible, and it sounds arrogant, and it sounds wrong. But if you'd been to UBN, and if you'd been brought up listening to pirate radio stations, then you suddenly discovered the way. And some of it was through no fault of their own, because we had needle time, we had all sorts of peculiar restrictions on us. We had to log every single record we played, PRS log. I spent more time filling out forms than I ever did speaking on the radio. And I always thought I was in radio because I didn't want to do any paperwork, you know, and it's all those kind of things. As it was laid out to me, I had to do interviews, I had to do this, I had to do, and it was really strange. It wasn't what I was expecting. And I had a £40 a week budget in which I had to pay contributors, and I had an astrologer called Joan Porter. She came out with all sorts of wonderful claptrap on a Thursday afternoon on my show, and there was another contributor called Ann Dover who would go and do women-style interviews. And I, just to give you the sort of idea, this isn't a pop music station, because my show isn't regarded as being particularly pop music. This is a radio station where we play a wealth of music. We have interviews and so on. And I'm following a program called Timber Tops, which is on at 1:30. And it runs for 15 minutes, and it's about a singing squirrel for children. And it wouldn't let me call it the Giles Squire Show. It had to be called the Just After Lunch Show. They decided to call it the Jal Show, J-A-L. And I'm called Giles Squire, and people started calling me Jal Squire. It was bizarre.
This is Giles Squire, and every day on Metro, I shall have the pleasure of welcoming you to a programme called Just After Lunch, or The Jal Show. It starts at 1:45.
We kicked off, probably the only radio station to kick off with a wonderful blooper of it going all horribly wrong, and that's because our tape machines, the minute you put power off, they would all go back, default back to a certain speed. And I think they defaulted back to 15 IPS. and not 7.5, which is what this tape was going to be played at. No one remembered that.
Right, so we go straight from the actual opening to the tape, right? That tape is queued up, that is, tape is not queued up.
Guess what engineers like to do just before you go on there? Let's reboot everything. Let's turn all the power off. So everything that had been sorted was unsorted, and no one thought about the tape machine.
The time is 6 o'clock, and to officially open the station, here is the managing director, Mr. Bruce Lewis.
We kicked off with every kind of program you can imagine. We had a daily soap called City. We had a program called the Clock Golf Quiz, presented by Dave Gregory, who, alas, we've also lost just this year. We had 13 journalists, 4 sports journalists, 4 or 5 technical operators. We had 5 or 6 producers. We had specialist programs coming out of the ears. Everything but a coordinated output.
Good morning. It is 6 a.m. on Monday, the 15th of July, 1974. This is Bruce Lewis saying welcome to Metropolitan Broadcasting.
We must have sounded so odd. We struggled to have listeners. We had, you know, we had phones. Of course, the great thing about those days was the sort of the invention of the phone-in, you know, and that was the big deal. You could ring your radio station. It didn't seem to have happened before. So I remember very, very early on being on air, and one of my Giles moments was running a mystery voice competition, and the mystery voice was Kirk Douglas. And it had come up to quite a hefty amount. There was about 530 quid at stake, which actually, in those days, is a lot of money. You know, we were putting £10 on and just rolling on and rolling on and rolling on. We got to the next caller, and it was on my show. And I said, OK, it's time to play for £530, the Kirk Douglas Mystery Voice Competition. So, caller number 3, it's Beryl from Stannington. What's the answer? And she goes, is it Roger Moore? And so it went on. No one heard me say it.
With the Giles Squire Show.
Let's catch up on some of the racing again. The 4 o'clock at Catterick. First number 3, Jemson at 7-4. Second number 7, Silver Seal at 6-1. Third number 9.
We really did struggle. And I think there were a few times when we probably had to get a cap in hand to the Independent Broadcasting Authority and say, you've got to help us because we're going to go under. Otherwise, I'm sure that there must have been conversation. Anyway, there was a coup in which the Bruce Lewis, the managing director, another classic moment. Giles is in Bruce Lewis's house talking to his daughter at the point they decide to run, as in Neil Robinson and others, a boardroom kind of coup, and he's ousted. And Neil took over. Neil Robinson, who was then, I think, the operations manager, but he took over as the managing director. We went through various different moments bit by bit. We had all sorts of lineup changes, and we used to do newses that were 25 minutes long.
Yes, it's called Roundup because that's exactly what it is. A roundup of events in the Northeast given a light magazine treatment.
It was bonkers, but we had a remit to do all this and we had to do it. And it wasn't really, despite what anybody says, it wasn't until 1984 when we started to really fight back. But by this time we'd had Canadian money put into us, American money, we'd had all sorts of money poured in various guises into us. And in 1984, by this point, a producer who'd been there called Mick Johnson was running Metro Radio. And I think it must have been 83 when I decided that Mick didn't like me, so he'd taken me off my afternoon show and shoved me all over the place, I think with a view to trying to get rid of me. And I resolved that there was no way I was ever going to leave Metro until it was something that was worth saying I'd worked there. Because I felt that if I tried to get a job and someone's at Metro, they'll just laugh, you know, and go, oh, that station. You know? One day I remember going to see Kath Hamill, who was Neil Robinson's secretary, and said, could I make an appointment to see Neil? And Kath said, well, you know, he's arriving at the airport. Why don't you go and collect him? Which I thought was a really smart move on her part. I said, all right, I'll go and collect him from the airport. I've been trapped in my car, so there's nowhere he can go. We're also on neutral territory, and I'm not sitting the other side of his desk and everything. And I said to him, but having been out in the doldrums and sulking for a couple of years or whatever, not done anything. I remember we'd had all the James Whale stuff and all of that stuff that had been and gone, because James was probably one of the most, you know, talked about bits of Metro then, because there wasn't else much to talk about. And I said to Neil, I want to do more than I'm doing, you know. And Neil said, I always did wonder about you, you know, kind of thing. And I said, well, I don't want to, you know, what have you got in mind? I said, well, I just want to take a greater role in this. This station, I've been here 10 years, and I want to work for a station that I can really feel proud of, you know, and really feel that it's an amazing radio station.
The first 10 years of commercial broadcasting by Metro Radio in the Northeast. And with the recent announcement that the Independent Broadcasting Authority has given us the go-ahead to broadcast for a further 8 years, we should be here until at least 1993.
So he said, oh, well, leave it with me. And absolutely nothing happened, as these things do. But then Mick discovered that I was actually chairman of the local PTA, because my son was at school, and I was actually, and he went, hang on, this bumptious sort of opinionated young man is actually the chairman of a local PTA. Some people must think he's got something to offer. He called me and said, look, I'm gonna make you senior presenter, and let's see what you do. And I went from senior presenter to presentation producer. They invented so many titles. I didn't mind, because I got a sort of incremental pay rise each time. So I got these sort of things where I went from senior that to senior producer. I thought, how can I be a senior producer when I'm a presenter? So I became assistant controller. And it was at the point where I went from assistant controller to controller that I remember a memorable day being on an underground in London with Neil Robinson, with Mick, with the others. And I just said, we're never going to go anywhere unless we think differently. And we'd had a lot of research done that had said all our listeners looked south, and that London streets were paved with gold, and Radio 1 was everything, and we could never beat Radio 1. And it cost us thousands. This research was fairly extensive. And to his credit, Mick as well, I just said, I don't believe a word of this. This is garbage in, garbage out. These are the same people, remember, because I had to sit there and talk to them. These are the same people who said they only love the music of the 60s, you know. And when we asked them to name 60s artists, they only named 70s artists. You know, if you say to yourself, if our presenters were as good as, or if not better than Radio 1 presenters, and I remember Neil saying, how are you going to do that? And I went, well, there's a way, because they all have to start somewhere. We just have to find them. And I said, our big problem is where we are geographically. You know, if you're sitting in London, why would you want to go 300 odd miles up the road to work in Newcastle, for goodness sake? Why? Because that's the only way you're going to get to Capital. It's the only way you're going to get to Radio 1. It's the only way you're going to get on national radio, to go to Metro first. So that's what I want. I remember standing on a tube station, train, going off it, but going, that's what I want. And Neil, at the end of it, said, well, that's a passionate speech. You have 50 grand. What? That's a huge amount of money. Metro launched on a £5,000 marketing budget. You have 50 grand to spend on a presenter. And I went, can I have 30 grand and 20 grand? And I know exactly who I might go for, you know. And he said, yeah, you have 50 grand, you do it. And that's how it started. And it started with Brian Lister, who joined as a technical operator, who is now a producer, and a man called Steve Martin. And he'd come and recently joined, and his background had been bus timetable scheduling. And you might not immediately think that's going to be the right background. But Steve and I became a sort of Bacharach and David, as it were. I was the devil, he was the detail. And what we realized is, no matter what we came up with or any ideas, we had to get these presenters to do it the way we wanted it. We wanted it to sound on air the way we had devised it, not to have presenters then articulate it their own way so it doesn't end up anything like. So that when you have a £7,000 car to give away, you don't get, oh, we have a £7,000 car, you've won it, oh, thanks very much, bang. You have, this car has this, it has alloy wheels, it has, you know, whatever it is. You build up the whole thing, you describe the car, you get into it, you get on air, you make the thing, you really sell it. Sizzle, not the sausage. We're going to really make people believe that everything that we do and what is exciting and interesting. And we devised a 5-point presentation plan, which I remember, first of all, relevance. When is a local story not a local story? When local people are thinking about it, it's a local story. So we wanted to do something called produced sound. And produced sound means that everything would have high production values, very high production values. I was very taken by going around a shop called Bainbridge, which became part of the John Lewis partnership. And John Lewis, and indeed Walt Disney, have a language. They describe everything in their own way. People are not employees, they're partners. And in the Walt Disney, they're cast members. They're all in the cast. And I loved that concept. I loved the idea that any language we used, and if we had different ways of describing things, we would teach our listeners to describe it with our language. So inadvertently, they would be articulating Metro's world, not just anybody's. So we would have everything in our own kind of way. And we would, of course, another of those, we would paint pictures. Everything would be very visual in your mind. We would have sound effects. We built, in audio terms, this amazing safe that would open every so often. And I kid you not to tell you that people in sales and even commercial production would come to the studio to look at our safe, which did not exist. It was just a series of sound effects. But we had to teach our presenters that it was like that, so that everyone described it the same way, because otherwise it would be bonkers, you know. So everybody had the memo with the full plan, and everybody followed, you know. One of the greatest things we did was the ice pyramid. And it came from, this is going right back to the early days of commercial television, when the Gibbs SR is in a block of ice, right? And I loved that concept. And Guinness came to us and said, would we come up with a promotion? And I said, well, why don't we put a golden Guinness can in the centre of this massive block of ice? And they loved it so much, they went with us rather than other radio stations.
It's tingling fresh. It's fresh as ice. It's Gibbs SR toothpaste.
Going back to the presentation side of it, I took a view that the only way to get the very best people is to find out who the best people were. And this all came about because Mick one day said to me, you know, why don't you take the day off and listen to the radio station? And I said, well, I don't really want to use a day's holiday. He said, no, I'll pay you. Just listen to the radio station. Because I said, you know, I'd just been sitting there saying, oh, I've got to paint the bedroom and I've got to do this. So I'll tell you what you do. You go and paint the bedroom and I'll pay you, but you have the radio on. And he was quite right, because when you're doing something, you're doing something, you listen, you hear all the things that are wrong with the radio station. When you're not necessarily concentrating, but you're doing something else like normal people do, you go, that doesn't work. And so I thought, well, actually, this gives me another idea. I'm going to go and listen to all the other radio stations. So I set off on trips armed with radio cassette players, as many as I could find. I took them off sales, whatever it is. And I would go and put myself on some hill somewhere. I remember somewhere on the M62, I could pick up enormous numbers of radio stations. I thought, this takes me back to my days of childhood when I'm dialing around and I'm finding all the radio stations. And I taped them. Unsolicited tapes of all these radio stations. I would tape presenters, make a note of who they are, look at them. Then I'd try and find out their JICRA ratings, stroke RAJAR, as if we moved from JICRA into RAJAR. And I would start a database. And I started a massive database of everybody who was on the radio. I scoured newspapers, any magazines, anything that was whatever it is, see if they got mentioned, if they were getting any kind of press at all, and I marked them. And it became really quite intensive. And on nearly always a trip, I'd hear someone I was interested in. I think, right, OK, I'm going to go and have a chat with them. Giles Squire Metro, all your favourite music. I became programme controller and then programme director of Metro, and Mick left me to it. I mean, I was left to do it all. 1982, Neil Robinson come to his senses that we couldn't go on this way. We had a staff that was way too big. I must be 60 people or more working in that building, and that's bonkers for a station that's losing money hand over fist. So he issued redundancy notices, and I think to this day, I just felt, you know, if you're, and I'm very supportive of unions and believe that there is a right and an absolute must that people's livelihood is protected and so on, and that there's somebody there and there's some sort of support and you've got all of that. So I'm very, and I dare not be because my daughter works for a union. I felt that I had the choice. I could either be in on the meeting where this was going to be talked about, or I needed to stand up now and leave. And I went, but I don't believe we should have this many people. And it's, you know, so I stood the other side of it and decided that I would be part of going forward, not walk out and go, I'm going to protest against it, because I didn't feel that protesting against redundancies was a sensible idea. And people should be realistic that this wasn't the way to go forward, that we were massively overstaffed. And if you looked at every other radio station, you could see that we were way beyond even some of the bigger stations and so on. So we had the strike, which meant that there were very few of us who could do any programs. And I remember that one of the days was a bank holiday, and I came in to do the breakfast show. I mean, the first day I walked over the, because I was an equity member and an ABS member, I got a very hard time. And I remember somebody ringing me up from the ABS. Actually, no one contacted me from equity, but it was implied by the person that that I would be blacklisted and that I would never work again. And I said, well, it's not my real name anyway, so I'll just change it and be somebody else, because I just felt I'm not going to be threatened. And they never said another word, and nothing else was ever said ever again. Anyway, this day I came in to do the breakfast show, and they were all there. And then, of course, I walked over to the canteen at 10 o'clock, having come in at 6 o'clock, to watch them realise that I was still on air, and I was still on air at lunchtime, and I was still on air in the afternoon, and finally packed up at 6 o'clock night, having done a 12-hour radio show, which is the longest radio show I've ever done and was probably dreadful. But just keep the music playing and keep playing the ads, and that's it. You know, that's all they could do. They then decided that this was probably not going to work, and the strike fell through and blah, blah, blah. And that's probably the start of where you go, OK, that's how I was that side of the fence. Oh, the acquisition side. Strangely, I to this day don't think we did that very well. I think we did some things well, but I don't think we, personally, I don't think we did the acquisition of the Yorkshire Radio Network very well. I think we went in there very arrogantly, and I think we should have listened more. And I really do think we went in with, we know all the answers, and we shouldn't. I mean, I wasn't really part of that because I looked after the northeast side, but I felt we had some things there that we should have kept, and we didn't. And I think there's a, you know, when you have truth by the tail, is when you think you know it all, then you know nothing, you know. So we sort of said we had a formula that worked, but you can't necessarily just pull out that formula and just stick it anywhere. When you add some things that, I think we should have said, we should have tempered a little bit of our formula and gone, but this works, and this, we should have just said, you're going to do it exactly that way, rather than kind of go, right, okay, we could grow this.
And then we send for tapes of the output complained about. It may be a programme, it may be an advertisement. And we listen to those tapes. And we also take the view of the company on the item complained of. And then we...
Funny, the one thing I've always had on my side from school days, I remember my reports, you know, Giles may not be, you know, brilliant at this or that in the early days, but he is thoroughly charming, is what they would go. And I used to be somebody at the radio, a lovely woman. I remember always slightly flirting with her and getting away with a few little bits and pieces because of that, and always being thoroughly nice. But the reality is, if I own up, we lied. I mean, we said we were doing things, we clearly weren't doing it. We found a way of covering it off in a different way. It's difficult to exactly remember what, but I know that we found ourselves doing our religious content like that. We did this like that. We did it different ways. We spent our musicians' union money on making jingles rather than these awful, which we spent over the years, these awful renditions of the same songs that just were horrible because of the needle time.
Metro.
I've heard people say that they can only work with people they like. I've always said I'm quite happy to work with people I don't particularly like, but actually that's very, very few, very few. I'm only interested in working with people with talent. I'm only interested in people who care passionately, want it as much as I do. And I used to say to people, I'll put 100% into you if you put 100% in. The minute you start slacking off, I'll slack off. One of the things I was renowned for is that I would say to you, right, okay, David, here's your contract, and you can sign it. Now, I'm going to spend the next year trying to find your replacement. Your job is to make sure I don't. But you're so good, I can't find anybody better than you. So that you spend a year proving to me that I made the right choice, because I'd seen, certainly in the early years of Metro and even at UBN, the minute someone got a contract, they just went in there and didn't care, you know. And I saw so much lack of interest. I was horrified. And the thing that horrified me the most, and I was probably a draconian at the time, is I remember walking into TFM and I remember saying, who listens to this radio station? And I think only one presenter put their hand up. And I went, you know, that's outrageous. You don't even listen to the radio station you work for. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to make it a must. You listen to this radio. So if that's unacceptable, please go now. And two people walked out the door. They were paid off. Nobody, you know, whatever it is. And I went, and anybody else who is not going to listen to this radio station, please leave now. Actually, in the end, I fired everybody except one person. It was just a frame of mind that actually we're just coming in and doing a job of work. And I went, no, radio has never been that to me. Radio, I used to say, I am the shop steward of the Union of Radio Listeners. And they're not happy. You know, they expect something from the radio. They might not articulate it, whatever, but they'll articulate it by switching you off to do something that is going to make some impact on their life. They're just going to switch you off and that's it. You know, that's consider that the equivalent of a strike. Metro was making a real strides, and I remember one day we had a meeting, and Neil said, what could we do? Far beyond the sort of, you know, whatever they call, you know, blue sky or whatever they call it now, but it's just four people who thought out of the box, wandering around, thinking and out loud, out of the box. And we came back and said, buy capital. And I remember Neil saying, well, they've got 20% of us. Well, it doesn't matter, buy them. We said, that's the only move you could do. For some reason, he didn't. And our problem was that Capital owned 20% of us and Chrysalis owned 20% of us. There was the problem that was going to come out at some point, because the minute Chrysalis decided actually they wanted out of their 20% because they wanted the money, because our share prices were amazing at that point, and we were a PLC by then. So the minute Capital said, oh, well, we'll do the same, we were sunk. It then had to be a takeover. You can't buy 40% of a company without going for the whole lot, apparently. So we found ourselves being bought, and being bought by EMAP, who seemed to me about 5 minutes earlier weren't even in radio. They literally just got in and bought the Transworld Group, and suddenly they bought us. And when I was in Los Angeles, I met this guy called Tim Schoonemaker, who I had no idea who he was. And he says, oh, we'll probably buy you one day. And I went, oh, yeah, as if, you know. And I remember being irritated at the time by all that and saying, it'll never happen, believe me, blah, blah, blah. And I remember when he walked through the door, he reminded me of that conversation. Oh, dear. It was very difficult, because then, of course, all the main people left, and I stayed. I found it very difficult to work in a group that didn't appreciate what it had. And I think a lot of other people in other parts of Transworld felt the same way, which is that I felt we were all gravitating to the lowest common denominator rather than actually sharing stuff that we could all feel good about and learning from each other. And we all got a bit protective. Tim Schoonemaker had a very odd way of managing people. He would come in and he would sit down opposite you and say nothing, absolutely nothing. You just get silence. And it was all about the fact that if you say absolutely nothing, somebody has to fill the silence. And I learned to say absolutely nothing back, partly because the ex-directors walked off and with large amounts of money, which I hadn't made from that deal, although I certainly made a bit. I remember that I'd been asked really early on to put some of my own personal money in. I put £50 in, I remember, to buy Metro shares. And I remember my accountant saying, "You've just wasted 50 quid." And I went, "Well, 50 quid, you know." It's... And anyway, I remember that 50 quid turned into 1,000. So that shows you how much it went up. So it was a reasonable turn. And yes, I had share options and stuff, but they walked away with millions, and some of us walked away a few thousand, but not millions. And they formed a new company called the Radio Partnership, and they bought chains of radio stations, including the Signal Group and Pulse. And actually, I'm the person who's responsible for calling that radio station Pulse, and I got it from the magazine called The Pulse in at an AAB, and I thought, what a great name for a radio station. And I always had a great idea that... for a great promotion, which in fact they did do, bless him, because Steve Martin took over as the program director, which was patient in the hospital. Doctor, come quickly. I think Pennine Radio's dying. You know, and there's all this, you know, they think, no, wait, I think I can hear a buzz.
So if you've just turned your radio on and you wonder what on earth is happening, we are the Pulse, playing all the hits all day. It's day one. I'm Elliot Webb. If you have just found us...
Anyway, we had this group, and they invited me to be their group program director. And, you know, I hesitated for at least 3/4 of a second and jumped ship as fast as I possibly could. And strangely enough, I think in 3 or 4 days, it's the anniversary of... It'll be 20 years since I left Metro, which is frightening to think this 20 years ago. And I cried. I cried and cried and cried. I could not. I'm a very emotional person. They had the staff meeting and everything, and I was supposed to say something, and I stood there and I looked at all of them, and I looked at the building and burst into tears and said, "I can't do this," and walked out the room, and that was that. I just couldn't. I went down to the office and bawled my head out. I went, it's my life. It's 22 and a half years. I've lived and breathed everything, and I felt I'd been... I had to go, because it wasn't me anymore. It wasn't... didn't feel that it was where... you know, I was leaving some very good presenters, very good people that I'd worked with. I knew it'd be fine. But I wasn't happy anymore. Well, the Radio Partnership, we got sold to the Wireless Group for 52 million, I think. I think my mum thought I was an absolute intergalactic millionaire. Didn't do badly out of it, but I wasn't a multi-millionaire. We formed a new radio station group called Forever Broadcasting, and our first acquisition, and I think we bought it for £1 million, was Crash in Liverpool, and we knew that was not going to work as a name. I just couldn't work out I can see people thinking they want to do something that's really innovative and outrageous, but from a commercial point of view, I could see, oh yeah, you know. Well, I was thinking, when we do stuff, you know, join British Airways and Metro Radio, and you got join British Airways and Crash.
Call the Crash sales team now and find out how Liverpool's new music alternative can get your business going and growing.
You couldn't see how you could do it commercially or do any of the sort of promotional sponsorship tags. So we needed to change it. And I remember being very much part of that. And we came up finally with the name Juice, which I loved. I mean, I did my very best to try and convince people that a mix of indie and dance music would work, but they're very, very different. And from there, we purchased a station in Brighton, which is called Surf, and renamed it Juice. We had a shareholding in, and part of the winning license of the Solent license then, 105.2, The Wave. It was a sort of mishmash of stations that was hardly a cohesive group, and, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and whatever. And eventually, I struggled a lot. I struggled with promises of performance. I struggled hugely with the team that wanted me to make Juice sound exactly like Galaxy. And I said, we can't do that within the remit. And in the end, we parted ways, and awfully and not well, and I've never really forgiven them for that, because we parted actually at Neil Robinson's funeral, and he died, and it wasn't really part of... And he was so poorly, wasn't really part of Forever Broadcasting. He had a shareholding in it, but wasn't really part of it. And he died. And I remember going to the funeral. I remember going back to the office, one of the gang saying to me, we can't continue. And I went, and this is because I fought tooth and nail to say, we're not going to do these things and break rules. And I think 6 months later, Juice had a yellow card and stuff. So as I rest my case, and that felt a bit bitter and horrible after all those years of working together. It was really not good timing and really bad to me because I like Neil a lot and felt, you could have waited to another day. And Keith Pringle and Julie Fair came to talk to me about Capital. And I said to Keith, it's probably time I came back into a bigger radio and stuff. And Keith said, well, what we've got in mind is that you look after the Century Group. And I thought, oh, that's a bit ironic. I remember Century arriving and all the ballyhoo. And I remember there being a lot sort of argy-bargy between Century and us, which I always thought was all a bit funny, really. And that whole Century thing was fascinating because I was, again, I could see that we were in a time of change and you could the amalgamation of GWR into Capital, all of that, and they were all sort of going on. And it just could sense, actually, for me, that this wasn't going to be a long-term prospect. And I think, David, there's a time in your life where you go, I didn't start in radio to be so far away from it all that I'm actually not able to enjoy the reason why I'm in radio. And what I got was a lot of stress, a lot of PLC, a lot of, why aren't we doing this, doing this? I mean, when I came in, Century was aimed at, it was music and football. It was like kind of aimed at men. I could not, it was insane. It was absolutely insane because men do not make the decision. I learned that at UBN, that women controlled what, the volume and everything.
Statistics show that Century FM play even more variety through the no-repeat workday.
When Century kind of ended, I was invited by Chris Van Schaik to come and talk to BBC local radio stations, which I found was really fascinating. And I spent 2 or 3 years consulting. But I was very uneasy doing it because consultants are people who borrow your watch and tell you the time and charge you a fortune. And I tried not to be like that. I was trying to open their eyes to things. It went well for a while. And then I used to crunch the numbers for them. And then eventually BBC said, no, we need to do this ourselves. And so that all ended. It was all going downhill for me anyway. When my brother died at the age of 52, shortly after my father died at the age of 88, and I had a terrible year because I lost our dog as well, and we'd lost other members of the family. My wife's gran, Nana, had also died, and I just suddenly thought, what's this all about? Decided, actually, I don't think I want to do this anymore. Decided that I would look after and manage some talent, and decided to run my own little record label, and which I've done. But now I used to be known as the axe man in Newcastle, and now I've got a really sharp axe. I can chop wood in the winter in the southwest of France and enjoy my life, and that's what I do. I don't really, can't say that I do very much. And so my pensions came in nearly 3 years ago, and that's fine. What was it that Carson said at Downton Abbey that I loved? It's a lovely line. He says, life is about collecting memories, and that's all there is in the end. But it is it's a collection of memories. There is a wonderful Robert Louis Stevenson quote about life and about... And I think I always keep it to hand, but I must quote it to you. And I think this to me, I found this amongst my father's things. And this is actually, that man is a success who's lived well, laughed often and loved much, who's gained the respect of intelligent men and the love of children, who's filled his niche and accomplished his task, leaves the world better than he found it, whether by an improved poppy or a perfect poem or a rescued soul, who never lacked appreciation of Earth's beauty or failed to express it, who looked for the best in others, and gave the best he had. That's how I'd like to be remembered.